Blog Talk Radio.
Nicholas Brousseau, and I am hosting the show along with Michael Klagstad. Why don't you say hi, Mike?
Hey, thanks for joining us.
Once again, we are discussing sexuality in a broad context. Thus, if you are listening with a young one around and feel they ought not to hear about sex explicitly, then it's probably best not to have them around while you're listening to this show. So this is your forewarning. Tonight, we will start by giving an outline of what was discussed in last week's show on sex, basically hitting the high points and then trying to take off from there. Given that tonight's show will be examining a meta-problem with sex, that is, what does a scientific perspective of sex offer us versus an ethical perspective, or more broadly, a normative perspective on sex, this seems to take an underlying philosophical issue within sex and within many other topics as well. As always, we encourage our listeners to call in and engage us in the conversation. So, Mike, why don't you start by pointing out one of the interesting things that was kind of determined in last week's show on sex?
Well, last week's discussion was sort of a dialogue on interesting artifacts of our society, things about sexuality that we found either interesting or inconsistent or noteworthy. First example that comes off the top of my head, we said last week that within our age bracket, I don't know how far this extends, you know, I wouldn't speak to other generations, but there's sort of this ongoing stigma, and it's not a universal thing, but it's a fairly strong stigma, that when, you know, it comes out within a social group that an individual is a virgin, first of all, it seems to be a minority, which I don't know whether or not that's actually the case, but it's certainly portrayed that way, at least in our age bracket social group. And then, you know, once it comes out that a person is a virgin, not only do they seem to be in a minority, but they receive sort of like this, I don't want to say, it's not necessarily a negative thing, but people question, you know, sort of like, well, what's wrong with you? Why haven't you, you know, had sex? Why are you still a virgin? And it seems as though people almost need justification for it to sort of like avoid scorn. You know, something like, oh, well, you know, I'm a Christian and I'm going to be a virgin until I get married. I'm going to remain chaste. Or, you know, another explanation might be I have some genetic illness or I have AIDS, you know, therefore that doesn't really make sense, kind of contradictory. But the point is, it seems as though people need a damn good reason to be chaste, or it seems as though there's something wrong with them. It seems as though there's something, what word am I looking for, Nick? It seems as though there's something abnormal with them.
Right, yeah. I would just say that it goes against the norm now, provided that you're an adult person, to say that you are a virgin without having, as it was phrased last week, a damn good reason.
Right.
Yeah, and on the other side of that, there's and you had mentioned this in last week's show, is the idea of the traditional stigma, where it's provided that you were born, let's say, in the 40s or something. If you weren't married, then all of a sudden it was like something was wrong with you. You know, it's like, why aren't you, especially if you were a female, like, are you just one of these people that no one else can put up with? So it seemed like a negative stigma really arose in that time period because of just the social norm was to, for a female to be married and become a housewife. And if she didn't
right.
do so, she was not fulfilling her role.
Right. You not conforming to what was to be expected at that time. Like, there was this idea that you couldn't settle down or that you were somehow unmarriageable or something like that. And I think it existed for men, too, but to a lesser extent. there was the idea that if a woman wasn't procreating or creating a good family, she was somehow insufficient. She was somehow not good enough. And
Now it seems that we're kind of have this temporal relationship between the societal norm of what is normal for sex, because used to be the case if you were in your 30s and you were unmarried as a female, then there was a negative stigma. Whereas now, if you're a male or female in your 30s and you're still a virgin, the question is what's wrong, you know, the same question arises is what's wrong with you. And it just seems to be that the only thing consistent with these things is that there's some sort of social norm that's being violated.
Right. I would agree with that. And you mentioned earlier, it goes against the norm in this day and age to be a virgin in your 30s. At the very least, it goes against the perceived norm. And whether or not that's actually the norm, I think, is up for debate. But the perceived norm, I think, is that that's somehow abnormal to be, you know, a 30- or 40-year-old virgin. And in a traditional sense, sort of what we're thinking of, you know, plenty of successful people, all that comes to my mind is female authors, you know, from the early 20th century, your Jane Austens, your Emily Dickinsons, who, you know, would have an incredible lasting impact on the world, and, you know, today are viewed with reverence, you know, almost as great creative forces of their time. During their time, I remember learning in my literature classes, were viewed with this stigma, like, okay, why can't you settle down? What is this silliness you're doing? Why aren't you married? Why aren't you having children? I agree absolutely, though, that the common denominator between the two is that some perceived social norm is violated.
Right, and I think this illustrates a point that John Stuart Mill talks about often in his work on liberty. And he refers to it as the tyranny of the majority. So, you know, like you mentioned some canonical figures or iconical figures of the 20th century who were going against the status quo, who probably, you know, were received not so well by their peers, but who are now are revered as these great people and offered a great deal to the advancement of the times, and took place because they were moving away from the status quo and they weren't, I guess, acquiescing to the majority. And I think that's something that's very difficult because of the negative stigmas we attach to them.
Yes,
and Mike, why don't you explain what the word stigma actually means? Because in the last show, my interpretation of the word stigma was that it automatically had a negative meaning in the word. But you were saying that it just means two things that are separate from each other. Is that right?
Well, you're right that stigma is a word we very often use with a pejorative context, and you know that's an acceptable definition. You know, a stigma can be seen as like on a if we say a person carries a stigma, it's like almost like a scarlet letter, you know, like a badge of something you've done wrong. Or a person can be stigmatized in the sense that, you know, they're set off as a failure or somehow unclean or unfit. But I converse with people interested in etymology quite a bit. And originally, the word, the literal meaning of the word is more like separate or different or individual and not so much negative, if that makes sense. To be stigmatized, you know, if the original understanding of the word was to be unique or set apart, not necessarily in a bad way, but somehow different.
It seems like we use the word stigma in such a pejorative context where I guess made the assumption. I looked up the word on Wiktionary, which probably isn't the best source to look it up on, but they kind of put it in a pejorative context as well. But you were saying with the etymology of the word that it's like, you know, it's not the case that it's like this. And so the way you seem to be describing stigma seems to be the way that kind of Jane Austen, Emily Dickinson, these characters were, they kind of idealize what it is to be a stigma, I guess, and
sure.
in a good light, because now we see that, you know, the things that they had offered.
Right. I think a good example just came to me. Are you familiar with the term stigmata in the sense of Christianity?
I saw some creepy movie called Stigmata, but I'd like to hear your definition of it rather than my assumptions about it according to that movie.
Okay. I think that, the stigmata, according to, traditional Christianity, is simply the marks impressed on Christ by the nails through his hands, by the lance in his side. Sort of like a holy spiritual mark that is incurred by the pain he endured. So that's sort of an interesting twist on it, too. It's not necessarily, viewed in that light, the word is not necessarily a negative thing as much as it is a setting apart or a stamp or, an individuality. And I don't know that, I'd necessarily want to say that Emily Dickinson or Jane Austen carried stigmata, but I think you're right that, they were separated in a way that afforded them unique perspective and the ability to succeed.
And the point I was trying to get to, and I wasn't doing such a good job at it, is that the word stigma carries this pejorative context, or at least has grown to carry a pejorative context, is because it goes against what the majority is doing at the time. And so automatically everybody's like, hey, what's this person doing? Let's shun them, kind of thing.
Yes. We had additional, a few other points we talked about last week. We covered what I think is something of a paradox. We were both asking, why is it that sex appeal and sexuality can be smeared across all forms of media and advertising and marketing, but it's taboo to talk about in a mixed social group, like talking to your parents about it is. It just seems wrong. I mean, at least I'm uncomfortable talking to my parents about it. I think that's a pretty normal thing. So we sort of discussed that. I don't know.
One thing I found interesting about that paradox relates to a man called Alfred Kinsey, who was kind of coined the name the father of sexology, who was I can't think of the exact term off the top of my head, but somebody who studies insects, and he was at this university and he noticed the wild ignorance in the community about sex, and so he started a class at I can't remember which university it was. I don't have it on hand. But there's a great movie called Kinsey that I suggest you check out. In any case, it's still one of the biggest sex studies that has ever been done. It's called the Kinsey Report. And he went around the United States and interviewed, I think, like over 300,000 people or something, like quite a few people.
Wow.
About their sex life. And one of the first things that you said starting out this show was, I don't know how many people are virgins or not, and it just seems like that information is so closed up that it's really totally speculation to kind of understand the broad picture of what a culture looks like sexually, because it's so, repressed, especially within our society. I guess you get into some smaller tribes, in South America or Africa, and it may become easier to understand a particular sex environment, or even in the United States, perhaps some group of people, you can look at them and examine some sort of, you can make some generalizations about their sexual behavior. But as a cultural whole, I feel that information is very withheld, and it's something that it seems to be is pushed to be withheld. And again, it's this paradox, because we see all through advertising is just appealing to this sexual energy that's within all of us. And it plays on our insecurities, as Radia had pointed out. That paradox seems to be in full force still today. And I'd also like to mention that Kinsey was very much stigmatized in his environment, but is again nowadays still revered as a great scientist who did some interesting work.
Yeah, absolutely. The last big topic I can remember discussing last week is the question. This is another modern, well, I don't know if it's so modern, but this is another artifact of society that I think is fairly modern. Why is it that a man is successful while a woman is a slut, you know, if both are sexually promiscuous? Another interesting paradox, you know, we discussed some various questions about that. Does it have to do with pregnancy? Does it have to do with the furthering of diseases? Those don't really seem to be like good explanations. It's just a social norm that has come to be, and I don't know that there's any justification for it.
Yeah, I don't really have much to add on that point either. It seems just another societal norm that's created that doesn't really seem to have a strong rationale for it, but it's just been perpetuated throughout time. And I think one of the things that we related it back to was the traditional stigma that that you had brought up, and that we're kind of moving, you know, from that traditional stigma, and now that's still kind of in place as the woman still needs to be this chaste, pure virgin, whereas the man is kind of free sexually. And I think that was one of the points we made.
Yep, that seems like it could be a reasonable stream of consciousness, how a norm could evolve along with society in that way, in that manner. That seems to make sense.
I'd just like to point out that that's really interesting that you talk of a stream of conscious within like an individual culture, so that there's this kind of, you can almost identify throughout time the way the stream of conscious works and how it evolves.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at cultures through history. I mean, that's just imposing my personal beliefs, but if I were going to do anthropology, I would do it in that fashion. So we were looking at these various aspects of our society, and the question we were sort of asking is, how can we explain these? You know, what story can we tell that explains why we react in certain ways, why we hold the norms we hold? And basically, in answer to our question, a man from Britain called in. I believe his name was Mike. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. Michael. Cool. Yeah.
Yep.
Mike or Michael. I was kind of calling them both.
Yeah, he called in, and he said, well, look, guys, this really isn't that complicated. You know, you're making mysticism out of something that's simple science. And he proposed that most, if not all, of these artifacts of modern society can be explained by our biology, by a twist on behavioral psychology, which simply says, you know, society in general evolves around procreation. You know, all of these double standards involving sex, the taboo-ness of talking in mixed company, you know, can all be explained by our attitudes towards mating. And, for example, he said, the reason we only communicate about sex within our age group has to do with our competition and our potential mates, where we don't see, you know, older age brackets or even parents as potential mates, and that has to do with, you know, why it's so taboo to talk about it. And I think that he presented a fairly rational explanation. Did you have anything you wanted to add to his commentary? Very insightful. He was very articulate.
Not particularly, but I don't know. Do you have anything you want to add to that? I guess the only thing that I saw with it was this idea that he was presenting somewhat that there's a biological explanation for a social evolution. And so it seemed like he was saying that our biology dictates our social interactions with each other, which I don't know if I can swallow that so easily, because our biology seems to be somewhat disconnected from our, at least in some circumstances, from our social interactions, particularly the human mind and its ability to use abstract thinking. It's hard to kind of see how the biology really fits into that. Rather, it seems like reason, or what we term as reason, to be kind of motivating, or at least in some circumstances motivating, beyond what is biological.
It does seem counterintuitive to say that, you know, society, which is presumably something we created, was sort of a creation of our genes instead of a creation of our minds, you know. It very much feels like a creation of my mind. I think you're right about that. Regardless, so we had this discussion of, you know, the explanation of sexual attitudes or possible explanations. And, you know, we discussed a few possible objections to the evolutionary biology perspective that Michael presented us with. You know, we talked about things like homosexuality, which seems to be somewhat contrary to, you know, procreation as a deterministic force in our society. Abortion, same thing. You know, it seems to be contrary to procreation as a purpose. Elective chastity, those sorts of things. But what I'd really like to note about last show is that we were having a very, I don't know if I want to call it scientific, it's definitely philosophical, but it was amoral. We were talking about sex in a way that was descriptive and not in a way that was proscriptive. We weren't talking about oughtness. We were just sort of, you know, playing, making a base. And this week, I think we'd really like to transition tonight's show into the ethics of sexuality, more than descriptive statements about it. So to start that off, we had a show a couple weeks ago now, I don't remember if it was two or three, with the Anscombe Society of Princeton, and a group of students who further this ideal. Nick, you worded greatly what their main tenet was, what their point was. I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you could do that for me again, exactly what the Anscombe Society sees their collective idea as.
Yeah, sure. I'll give it a shot. I do want to say this before I continue on, though. Right now, the Blog Talk Radio switchboard is it's connecting and it's loading. So if you're trying to call in or have been trying to call in, right now I'm having issues with it. But it sounds like we're still broadcasting fine. So we're just going to continue on. And please be patient if you're calling in right now. In any case, what I think the Anscombe Society's main, I guess, philosophical argument, and perhaps the strongest one, seem to be that sexual intercourse is this interpersonal interaction between people. And because of this, there's an emotional attachment, this very strong emotional attachment, and last week we kind of fleshed that out more, saying that yes, there's something you know, that we kind of agree with the Anscombe Society in saying that there is something that is more intimate and more tied with the affective faculties or the emotions of one person when sex is involved with the situation. And so their central argument was that if one's to engage in sexual activity with another, they ought to be deeply emotionally invested with this person. I think they were going as far to say that marriage is really what it needs to be. But I think, you know, to be charitable with what they're saying, you need to move away from the boundary of marriage, because there are serious relationships that, you know, are worthy of the merit of marriage.
Right, yeah. And they were willing to entertain marriage-like situations in other cultures, you know, which don't have an idea of marriage. You know, they weren't coming from any particular conservative or religious perspective. They just seemed to say that, you know, look, sexual intercourse can be a potentially damaging interpersonal relation, and, you know, it ought to be handled so. You know, it ought to be handled carefully and with respect. And, I think their main claim boils down to it's better for people to handle sex, you know, with a more traditional conservative attitude than it is to sort of play fast and loose or avoid the hookup culture that they've seen at school. So anyway, that's one particular view that we've discussed greatly on the show about, you know, how we ought to look at sex as a sophisticated, deeply emotional interpersonal relation. I guess what I would like to do, I don't know about you, Nick, it's kind of where I see the show going, is I'd like to entertain, you know, some other views and, you know, talk about some other oughtnesses that we can find with sex. You know, and ask things like, you know, is that the case? Is sex, you know, a delicate interpersonal relation, or can it be totally void of emotion? Can it be, you know, very formal and drawn and contrived?
In my opinion, and again, in the last show, we kind of started out saying that we've been collecting kind of anecdotes from different people we're connected with about their sexual environment and how they feel about it. And one individual that I spoke with talked about this idea of serial monogamy. And as I was asking her through the points, you know, she seemed to be very candid with me. And the idea of serial monogamy is that you would sleep with one person only at one time, but you don't need to be, it's not by necessity that if you sleep with somebody or have sex with somebody that you are deeply emotionally invested with them. She did say, however, that what is needed in this relationship is these boundaries. And the boundaries are such that there needs to be good communication amongst the two partners involved to identify where their emotional status lies. Because it may be the case that one starts out in a sexual relationship with somebody and the emotions are void, that it's like, well, I still see you as a friend. I don't see you, I don't know if the right word would be romantically or somebody I want to establish a long-term relationship with. But I do find you attractive, and I would like to have this sex relationship with you. And provided that both parties are on this same page and stay on that same page, and also are willing to describe when or if the emotions change, where one person becomes emotionally invested, then they need to be able to step up and say, listen, I'm emotionally invested. I'm expecting more out of this thing. Where do you stand? Where do you lie? So it takes that facet. It also takes a level, as she described it, was loyalty or trust, and that the monogamous part, as it suggests, is that one person should only be sleeping with one person. And the reason why she holds this tenet is because it provides her the safety aspect, which we talked about as the last week we determined that one of the reasons for somebody remaining chaste or not being a person who has sex with a lot of people is to protect their body and, you know, to avoid STDs, HIV, unwanted pregnancy, etc. And so if one person is only sleeping with one person, then this allows for an understanding to occur, I guess, where they're only sleeping with each other. They've established this. So it does take trust. And it sounds like there can still just remain on a friendship level so long as people are willing to really communicate what it is that they're feeling at that particular, in that particular relationship. So I think that really answers to all of the different aspects of kind of a friend with benefits or a friend who you have sex with, answers to all the problems that we presented of sleeping with a person you're not deeply emotionally invested with. That was quite a lot there. Sorry about talking so much there.
No, okay. Nick just presented an alternative view of sexuality. Serial monogamy, it is on Wikipedia. I checked. You can look at it. But I think the basic idea there is to, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, in some practitioners, to sort of like avoid emotional attachment to begin with. It's sort of, you could almost see it as a solution, I don't want to say similar to the one the Anscombe Society has found, but parallel, in that it avoids, you know, damaging interpersonal relations. I don't know if you think that's good or not. But to sort of tie this back, you know, we said we were going to survey other cultures. Bit of a stretch here. But a place where we find serial monogamy in biology is in birds. They have this exact practice. They will choose a partner for a mating season. They'll remain monogamous with that partner for a mating season. And then next mating season, they'll simply move on. You know, they'll simply select again. You know, and there are birds that mate for life. There are birds that select the same mate from season to season. But it's also very common to have a nesting partner for a season and then move on. So I don't know if we can – might be a bit of a stretch to call that a cultural survey, but we do certainly see this type of attitude towards sex in nature.
Which I think is interesting, just on another facet, is that there's also humans, you know, because you describe, well, there are birds that do find one mate for the rest of their time. Pretty sure penguins do, as well as swans. But in any case, it just seems like there seems to be this relativity between, even in the animal kingdom and the human kingdom. I know that they're kind of in the same kingdom, I guess, in the biological hierarchy, but we definitely distinguish ourselves from animals almost all the time. So just to say that it seems that there's a relativity within the natural and the human, or the human and the animal, this relativity between what they feel is right, I guess.
Absolutely. Sort of continue on the survey from a more, I guess, an ancient perspective, even archaeological perhaps. There is a strong sense, a strong scholarly sense. It's not universal, you know, as it tends to be. Historical scholars do disagree. You know, there is no common consensus. But a strong authority in ancient Greece, experts of ancient Greece, say that, you know, bisexuality and experimentation was very normal. You know, we talked about this last week too, sort of in response to some of Michael's comments, but more generally, just that at least through childhood, there was really no distinction between a hetero person or a homosexual person. It was sort of just like, you know, sex is free and clean and it's part of learning, and it was romantic, you know. It was very much involved with one's emotions, and ideas like, you know, loyalty were there, monogamy a bit more hazy, but also there. The general idea, though, was that, you know, a person, as they grew up, like young boys, would be bisexual. They would experiment, and eventually they would settle down, and the word that is used by scholars is belove. They would belove a hetero partner. And there were, you know, some couples that remained homosexual all their lives, but it was sort of seen as like promiscuity in youth, all types of sexuality, and settling down into a, you know, a, what's the right word, in a relationship, you know, that would procreate, in a relationship that would extend the gene pool. And Michael was arguing last week that that type of homosexuality and bisexuality makes a great deal of sense from a biological perspective, because it results in increased libido and ultimately ends in better procreation. Whether or not, you know, that's a good argument, I won't get into, but, you know, just saying that's sort of consistent. There were definitely, that's not to say, you know, that it was universal in ancient Greece, this promiscuity or bisexuality. I know Plato, for one, definitely argued for chastity until marriage, I think, or, you know, maybe some other type of union. Was he even lifelong chastity? I'm not sure.
Who's that, Plato?
Yeah.
I'm not sure of his the extent of his life, but I know that in the last dialogue called the Phaedo, he definitely appeals to chastity. He doesn't explicitly say chastity, so I'm not 100% sure on exactly his whole life. And in the way that he's describing this, I would imagine that it's not chastity in its whole life, but just that one ends up reaching this point. And the reason why I say that is, I mean, you'll have to read the Phaedo for yourself. There's a lot of arguments for why the soul is kind of eternal and everlasting. And it's also interesting at this point in the dialogue, it's called the Phaedo, I don't know if I mentioned that, that the body is kind of connected with the soul in kind of this weird way, but the soul kind of represents the eternal and the body represents the human part. So one's divine, the soul part, and the other part is human. And what one does with their body is what's going to propel them into the next life, or what's going to allow their soul to either stay connected with their body or to become one with the divine. And obviously, the soul removing itself from the body and becoming one with the divine is the greater part. And so with that kind of contextualized, I'm going to read what he says about, this is where he actually mentions sexuality. Plato writes, "But I think that if the soul is polluted and impure when it leaves the body, having always been associated with it and served it, bewitched by physical desires and pleasures to the point at which nothing seems to exist for it but the physical, which one can touch and see or eat and drink or make use of for sexual enjoyment, and if that soul is accustomed to hate and fear and avoid that which is dim and invisible to the eyes, but intelligible and to be grasped by philosophy, do you think that such a soul will escape pure and by itself?" "Impossible," he said, and this is Sebes who is responding to Socrates' statement in question. And so what I think is being illustrated there is that this idea of purifying the soul is able to move the soul to this heightened state. And so although this seems like very metaphysical stuff going on, you know, I suggest you read the Phaedo because they're very interesting arguments, the way that he kind of moves through these things. So in any case, that's another kind of ought, I think, being represented by Plato here, is to say that to move one away from, and not only sexual pleasure, but all pleasure, is to, purify the soul. So basically keeping your mind in this contemplative realm versus being focused on the bodily stuff.
Right, and I think I would even go so far as to say that Plato is looking at sort of the bisexual promiscuity of his time as like philandering, like it, as you said, it impures us. His words, actually, you know, that it robs us of our purity. You know, it makes us focus on the physical, and you know, we're devoid of the higher stuff. Yeah, so it definitely wasn't universal within the ancient Greek culture, but there are some interesting perspectives there. Another culture that we've discussed on a few different shows now, I think dating all the way back to the Anscombe Society, I spoke of an African tribe for which marriage was kind of a very different idea than what we hold, you know, it's a traditional Western ideal. For them, I shouldn't say was, because, you know, they're an existing tribe and they still behave this way. In this tribe, they're called the Maasai, mostly of Kenya, although I think they exist in a few other countries on the African continent. The idea of marriage, and this isn't universal, you know, there are some Maasai that have sort of westernized their views of mating and marriage, but this is the traditional Maasai. Marriage at that, you know, in this tribe is viewed as a union not between a man and a woman, but between a woman and a man's age bracket, if that makes sense. So in their tribe, you know, as a man sort of hits puberty, or I should say as a boy hits puberty and becomes a man, you know, they have a very ritualized process by which a man becomes a man, a warrior, a hunter, these sorts of things. He's joined by everyone else in his age bracket. You might call it a generation in our Western culture, a period of about 10 years, you know, all these boys are lumped together. And when one of them marries a woman, it's sort of seen as like she's marrying herself to that group of the tribe. Not necessarily a union between the two, but like a family. How I would really explain it is they view the entire tribe as a nuclear family, that, you know, each man is a husband to each wife in their age bracket. Kind of hard to wrap your head around, very different from what we think of. But sexuality within the tribe, I mean, one thing I was reading in some of my research was that in their culture, when a man is visited by another man, you know, and sort of stays with him in his home, it's considered polite to give up his bed and concurrently his wife. Now, his wife, you know, can choose not to lie with this other man, but the idea is, you know, it's like, okay, you come into my home, so I'll offer up to you what is mine, and that includes, you know, my marriage. That includes my wife. It seems like an incredibly foreign, different, you know, almost alien view of sexuality, but it works. You know, there are tribes that live this way exclusively. You know, personally, I would have questions like jealousy. You know, how could that many men and women not kill each other? You know, how could they be sharing sexual partners and not see fierce competition and these sorts of things? But, you know, as it turns out, incidence of crime within these tribes is incredibly low, and there happens not to be much jealousy. So I think they would treat oughtnesses of sex in a way like not so very different from the Anscombe Society, but I think they would have a different idea of what it means, you know, appropriately have sexual relations and appropriately raise children. You know, they might say that a group of people is better suited at raising children than a man and a woman, you know, sort of like many minds is better than one. I don't know. Any thoughts on the Maasai?
No, I mean, it's just incredibly fascinating and so much different from my perspective that, you know, it's really hard, like you were trying to derive this ought out of it, and, you know, it's tough. It's tough to really understand what that ideology is like. Do you have anything else? Because I was gonna explore another cultural difference in sexuality that I've heard of.
Go for it.
Actually, in a sociology class, Professor Sophia Kofopoulos, who was of Greek descent, was describing to me how it's not uncommon for a mother and father of a son to hire a prostitute for their son's first sexual encounter. And the idea, I guess, behind this is it's supposed to get the boy experienced in such a way with his sexuality to be comfortable and to have a healthy first sexual experience. So that when he were to meet his potential life mate, that he wouldn't be, I guess, a disaster in the bedroom. Now, she didn't phrase it all quite in this way, but that's the general idea that I got out of it. And so the ought, I guess, kind of derived from that, it seems to be like sex is a very important part of a relationship, which I think is something that's also agreed upon within our society. But the idea of, like, the actual family being involved with the sexual upbringing of an offspring is very unusual. So I don't know. Any thoughts on that, Mike?
And that's a modern Greek culture, right? That's, like, today or 20th century, I assume. Is that right?
Yes.
No additional points. That's interesting. You can see, you know, why a person would think something like that. I think some of us might be appalled by that, but at the same time, you know, there's a certain efficient practicality to it. I don't know if that makes sense to you or not.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. One thing I do want to mention before we go on, Mike, is that I'm working on getting the switchboard up. I am opening it in a new window as we speak. I'm trying to get it so that we can have some callers on board. I'm trying to do that, so please be patient. We would love to have your insight. I know that there's only about 17 minutes left, so please stay on the line if you're interested.
Okay. I know one thing we've been promising our listeners for quite a while now, at least two shows, is a discussion of tantric sex. And I don't know that we can pinpoint a specific culture. I guess I would say if Buddhism can be described as a culture and not, you know, a spirituality or a religion, sort of a survey in that direction. You were telling me it was actually Hindu, though. Is that right?
Well, there is both Buddhist and Hindu traditions of tantric sex. The one that I read a book on by Diana Richardson called The Heart of Tantric Sex is based on a Hindu formation of tantric sex, and I believe it originated in the Hindu tradition.
Okay. I don't mean to put you on the spot about it, but I really don't know that much about it. Can you give us sort of like a 10-cent description of, you know, the attitude that Tantra holds towards sexuality?
Yeah, sure, I'll do that. And I just want to say that I have the switchboard up, so we have one caller on the line. And after I give my brief description of Tantric, I will get to that caller. I guess I'm going to give a pretty brief description of this. I would encourage people to check out Tantric Sex as an alternative understanding of sexuality from the Westerner's point of view. And I think the major difference that exists between the Western idea of sex, or the sex view that I was brought up in, is the idea of, as she phrases it in the book, is Western sex is, and particularly, I guess, sex in general, seems to be focused on an orgasm. So sex is this build-up towards this sexual ecstasy for a few seconds, whereas tantric sex is focused on sex without the orgasm orientation. Rather, what it is trying to do is become more conscious with the self during a sexual act. So it's all about, it's a very, you're not worrying about the other person. In fact, you're really focused on your own internal mechanisms and what's going on, how you're feeling, and actually to become more, as she phrases it, genitally conscious. So you have a deeper communication with your body, and you can feel things much more. There's no essential friction of back and forth within tantric sex. Rather, the only movement that's really attained during tantric is through changing positions. Also, one of the tenets is, at least in the fundamental or traditional sense of tantric sex, is that there would be a mentor. I don't know exactly how the mentor works in it all, but they kind of guide you through this. And so I guess the one parallel I want to draw is that one of the things that we determined is that there needs to be a level of trust, even within the friends with benefits types of things. And it seems that trust needs to be a big part of tantric sex, or at least two people who are very, very comfortable with each other, because it's essentially meditation with sex. So if you've ever tried to meditate and, you know, sit in a room quietly and clear your mind, you know, and to not think about anything, well, imagine trying to do that with another person in a room, and then try to imagine doing that while you're either being penetrated or are penetrating. So with that said, I'm going to take a caller, and I know that the caller is probably not going to relate to this exact point, but that is okay. We are down to make some tangents wherever it happens, I guess. So here we go, caller.
Hello?
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 Caller, welcome to the show.
Gee, thanks for clicking me in right around the tantric sex part.
I know it's...
I'm like cracking up over here as you're introduced. But actually, it's not... I've been on the line for a long time. But the point that I've been trying to make actually fits in somewhat with what you're talking about, because it seems like tantric sex, you're really focused on yourself, and you know, it's an act of meditation, and one meditates for the sake of greater clarity in one's life, so that sex is being used as a very challenging meditational exercise. Is that an accurate statement? Hello?
Hello? I think we lost Nick.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, he'll call back in. This has happened to me before because he's hosting the show, so hopefully
right.
He'll presence. Are you there?
I am.
Okay.
I would love to answer your question about Tantra, but unfortunately, I don't really know anything about it other than what Nick is posting.
I just came back in. Sorry about that. I muted my phone and I couldn't unmute it. It was a problem. I'm sorry.
Okay. What I was basically, I was trying to make sure that I understand what tantric sex is. So correct me if I'm wrong, that it's an advanced form of meditation.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I would phrase it. I don't feel comfortable as phrasing that as an extreme generality. But yes, that's my understanding of it.
And one meditates out of self-interest. It really seems like, you know, when you're talking about you're engaging in sex, you're not really thinking about the other person so much, but more on yourself. The focus is yourself, and this is done for one meditates for greater clarity, which helps oneself. And my point, which has nothing to do with tantric sex, but everything to do with sex and the relationship to self-interest and the oughts that you guys have been talking about, is this. And this is a totally, totally different point. And how much time do we have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay. So this is an angle that you guys have not explored. When you've been talking about the oughts of sex, there's like the self-interest ought in the sense of prevention of STDs and whatnot. It seems like tantric sex is also a type of self-interested ought. Like, you ought to be focused as much as you can in life and be able to be focused amongst the, in the most complex situations, such as sex. So that's a good thing. But I also wanted to just throw in there something from, Alan Bloom, and this is a book called The Closing of the American Mind. And in the beginning of the book, he's talking about music. And this is a totally different direction, but maybe not. But basically what he says, and he's pretty much criticizing rock music, because rock music is really taking advantage of the sexual awakening of adolescence. And Alan Bloom points out that, like, the sexual awakening and also one's intellectual awakening are happening around the same time. And what rock music does is sabotage, like, the sexual passions. And it actually prevents a passionate relationship between the individual and ideas, which is really, like, the ultimate pleasure. And I think, you know, going back to the Phaedo, it's not like Plato is eschewing all pleasures. He's eschewing the bodily pleasures as being the most supreme, and it's contemplation, which is like the ultimate pleasure. So similarly, Alan Bloom says, look, like, human beings, you know, to put it bluntly, get off discussing ideas and engaging passionately with ideas. And what rock music does is, like, sabotage this part of our being. And it may also explain why you guys are talking about, like, why do we not imagine older people, like, having sex? And I would argue that that's because we don't see old people on MTV. I mean, it's like a lot of young people. And so, like, sex, drugs, rock and roll, blah, blah, blah. And this is Alan Bloom's point. He's, like, slammed by the left as being this conservative prig. But I just want to read you a sentence because Nikki's onto something. And he says, the first sensuous experiences, so the first, like, sensuous tastes that you have, are decisive in determining the taste for the whole of life, and they are the link between the animal and spiritual in us. The period of nascent sensuality has always been used for sublimation and the sense of making sublime, for attaching youthful inclinations and longings to music, pictures, and stories that provide the transition to the fulfillment of the human duties and the enjoyment of human pleasures. And right before that, he says, you know, I'm concerned about music because I believe it ruins the imagination of young people and makes it difficult for them to have a passionate relationship to art and thought that are the substance of liberal education. So it's a totally different angle of, like, the aughts of sex, and I'm just throwing it out there for the sake of discussion, that, you know, it could also be in your self-interest to say no to these passions when you're an adolescent, because they may, like, if you indulge in them too much or whatever, they sort of cut you off. You become, like, addicted to those pleasures rather than having, like, an erotic relationship to ideas. And Plato definitely talks about the philosopher as someone who has an erotic relationship to ideas. And that is all I have to say. Sorry, I'm still jet-lagged and exhausted, but I'm sorry if that was unclear.
No, I found it very insightful. But it seems to be saying then, so in adulthood, one could enjoy rock music and sex, drugs? So long as the mind was mature philosophically, I guess, or to have an erotic understanding with the idea realm?
Well,
is that,
you know,
fair to say?
This is a deep question. I mean, if you're going to go with, like, a theory of, you know, human flourishing, which posits a very specific type of pleasure, as, you know, that is what it's like to flourish, and it's not sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And, you know, this is an area of debate. I would say, like, Plato would say no. Alan Bloom is very influenced by the Greeks, and he would say, no, the people who actually think that flourishing is sex, drugs, and rock and roll get it wrong. I realize that in our society, we're afraid to say no, you know, like people are wrong about their views of flourishing. So anyway, I'll just leave it at that. That's a question for, what do you guys think? Do you think that someone who is pursuing sex, drugs, and rock and roll throughout their life solely is missing out on something, or is that, are they flourishing, or what? He actually talks about Mick Jagger in the book, and I don't know. You know, I think Mick Jagger, I consider him to be, at least now, quite wise, in my view. I mean, when you ask, when you hear him talking about performing, like, he's an artist, and he takes it extremely seriously. So maybe it's always been there, and it's a more pure form. I don't know what his relationship to drugs is now. Anyone, do you guys know? Is Mick Jagger clean, or anybody know?
No, I have no clue.
I mean, he seems to be a contemplator of some sort. So in any case, I want to say that Alan Bloom singles out Mick Jagger as, like, bad. He also talks about Michael Jackson. So these guys are, like, bad for our youth because they're sending the wrong message. But anyway, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
I would say it depends on one's relationship with the sex, drugs, or rock and roll. And again, I think it comes down to perhaps the kind of a principle that's been brought up by Tantric and then now again by you of this kind of, it's for one's self, for the betterment of oneself, and I guess specifically chosen by the will to cultivate certain things that will help that individual flourish. I think the hardest one to argue for is drugs. I mean, rock and roll, you get the performance thing, and I just recently saw a rock and roll show that was, like, so incredible, and you could tell these musicians took their art very seriously. You know, we're very... In any case, I guess I don't need to bring that up, but the drugs aspect, I think, so you have these mind-altering drugs, you know, that have these certain effects on individuals, you know, and it's not uncommon for certain people to, like, freak out and da-da-da-da-da. Well, if one's taking a drug to, you know, just to get high, I think is different than somebody who's taking a drug to explore, you know, to say, I'm going to take this drug and I'm going to, you know, I don't know if I'm going to push my sanity, but I'm going to test the rational capabilities that I can have on such and such. And maybe that's not a fair analysis of what a good drug user would be.
No. Mike, do you have anything? How much time do we have?
We just have 9 seconds. So.
Okay. Yeah. So.
So I think we'll have to close this out as of right now. And I'd also like to say I'm sorry for the switchboard malfunction. It is still currently malfunctioning. Actually, funny thing, it just came up. It just reloaded, and there is another caller, but we are not going to take that because we have about 60 seconds.
Right.
So in any case, thanks for tuning in to Ethics Talk. Perhaps next week we will pick up on this. And,
one discussion I think that we've sort of been heading into that we still can't seem to get to, I think we'd really like to discuss the normativity of sex, you know, how we can evaluate or even if we should evaluate it in a normative fashion. I don't know if that's coming in the future or not. I guess we'll see.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. This has been Ethics Talk. Good night.